Maddock and I share a swift look. The one thing we agree on is that Oak will be kept safe. I am glad he's far from here. Inland, with both spies and knights looking out for him. But if Cardan is correct about what the line means, I wonder if he will need even more protection than that.
If the Undersea is planning to steal Oak, then perhaps they promised Baelkin the crown, says Mikhail. Safer for there to be only two in the bloodline, when one is needed to crown the other. Three is superfluous. Three is dangerous.
Which is a roundabout way of saying somebody should kill Baelkin before he tries to assassinate Cardan. I wouldn't mind seeing Baelkin dead either, but Cardan has been stubbornly against the execution of his brother. I think of the words he said to me in the Court of Shadows. I may be rotten, but my one virtue is that I'm not a killer.
I will take that under advisement, advisors, says Cardan. Now, I wish to speak with Nikasia.
But we still haven't decided, Randolin says, trailing off when he sees the scorching glare Cardan levels at him.
Jude, go fetch her,
says the High King of Elfheim. Another order. I get up, grinding my teeth, and go to the door. The ghost is waiting for me. Where's Nikasia? I ask. It turns out that she's been put in my rooms with the roach. Her dove-gray dress is arranged on my divan as though she's posing for a painting. I wonder if the reason she rushed off was so she could change clothing for this audience.
Look what the wind blew in, she says when she sees me.
The High King requires your presence, I tell her. She gives me a strange smile and rises.
If only that were true.
Down the hall we go, knights watching her pass. She looks majestic and miserable at once. And when the huge doors to Cardan's apartments open, she goes inside with her head high. While I was gone, a servant brought in tea. It steeps in a pot at the center of a low table. A cup of it steams in the cage of Cardan's slender fingers.
Nikasia,
he drawls.
Your mother has sent a message for us both.
She frowns, taking in the other counselors. The lack of an invitation to sit, and the lack of an offer to take tea.
This was her scheme, not mine.
He leans forward, no longer sleepy or bored, but every bit the terrifying fairy lord, empty-eyed and incalculably powerful.
Perhaps, but you knew she'd do it, I'll wager. Do not play with me. We know each other too well for tricks.
Nikasia looks down, eyelashes brushing her cheeks.
She desires a different kind of alliance.
Perhaps the council might see her as meek and humbled. But I am not yet so foolish. Cardan stands, hurling his teacup at the wall, where it shatters.
Tell the Queen of the Undersea that if she threatens me again, she will find her daughter my prisoner instead of my bride.
Nikasia looks stricken. Randolin finally finds his voice.
It is not meet to throw things at the daughter of the Undersea.
Little fishy, says Fala. Take off your legs and swim away.
Mikhail barks out a laugh.
We must not be hasty, says Randolin helplessly. Princess, let the High King take more time to consider.
I worried that Cardan would be amused or flattered or tempted. Instead, he's clearly furious.
Let me speak with my mother.
Nikasia looks around the room, at the counselors, at me, before seeming to decide that she's not going to persuade Cardan to send us away. She does the next best thing, turning her gaze only to him and speaking as though we're not there.
The sea is harsh, and so are Queen Orla's methods. She demands when she ought to request, but that doesn't mean there isn't wisdom in what she wants.
Would you marry me, then? Tie the sea to the land? And bind us together in misery? Cardin gazes at her with all the scorn he once reserved for me. It feels as though the world has been turned upside down. But Nikasia does not back down. Instead, she takes a step closer.
We would be legends, she tells him. Legends need not concern themselves with something as small as happiness.
And then, without waiting to be dismissed, she turns and goes out. Without being ordered, the guards part to let her by.
Ah, says Matic. That one behaves as though she is queen already.
Out, says Cardin. And then when no one reacts, he makes a wild gesture in the air.
Out! Out! I am certain you wish to deliberate further as though I am not in the room. So go do it where I am not in the room. Go and trouble me no more.
Your pardon, says Randolin. We meant only out, he says.
At which point even Fala heads for the door.
Except Jude,
he calls.
You, tarry a moment.
You. I turn toward him. The humiliation of the night still hot on my skin. I think of all my secrets and plans, and of what it will mean if we go to war with the Undersea, of what I've risked, and what is already forever lost. I let the others leave, waiting until the last of the living council is out of the room. Give me an order again, I say, and I will show you true shame. Locke's games will be as nothing to what I make you do. With that, I follow the others into the hall. In the Court of Shadows, I consider what moves are possible. Murder Bailkin. Mikkel wasn't wrong that it would make it harder for the Undersea to wrest the crown from Cardin's head. Marry Cardin to someone else. I think of Mother Marrow, and almost regret interfering. If Cardin had a hag's daughter for a bride, perhaps Orla wouldn't have engaged in such martial matchmaking. Of course, I would have had other problems. A headache starts up behind my eyes. I rub my fingers over the bridge of my nose. With Taryn's wedding so close, Oak will be here in mere days. I don't like the thought of it with Orla's threat hanging over Elfheim. He is too valuable a piece on the strategy board. Too necessary for Bailkin. Too dangerous for Cardin. I recall the last time I saw Bailkin. The influence he had over the guard. The way he behaved as though he were the king in exile. And all my reports from Vulsabur suggest that not much has changed. He demands luxuries. He entertains visitors from the sea who leave puddles and pearls behind. I wonder what they've told him. What promises he's been made. Despite Nikasia's belief that he won't be necessary, he must be hoping just the opposite. And then I recall something else. The woman who wanted to tell me about my mother. She's been there the whole time. And if she's willing to sell one kind of information for her freedom, maybe she's willing to sell another. As I think over what I'd like to know, it occurs to me how much more useful it would be to send information to Bailkin instead of getting information out of him. If I let that prisoner believe I was temporarily freeing her to tell me about my mother, then I could drop some information in her ear. Something about Oak. Something about his whereabouts or vulnerability. She wouldn't be lying when she passed it on. She would believe she'd heard true and spoke truth. I puzzle further and realize, no, it's too soon for that. What I need now is to give the prisoner simpler information that she can pass on. Information I can control and verify, so that I can be sure she's a good source. Bailkin wanted to send Cardin a message. I will find a way to let him. The Court of Shadows has begun to formalize the scribing of documents on the denizens of Elfheim, but none of the current scrolls deal with any prisoners in the tower but Bailkin. Walking down the hall, I go to the Balm's newly dug office. She's there, throwing daggers at a painting of a sunset.
You didn't like it? I ask, pointing to the canvas.
I liked it well enough, she says. Now I like it better.
I need a prisoner from the Tower of Forgetting. Do we have enough uniforms to dress up some of our new recruits? The knights there have seen my face. Vulsiber can help smooth things over. But I'd rather not risk it. Better to forge some papers and have her out with fewer questions. She frowns in concentration.
Whom do you want?
There's a woman. I take a piece of paper and grit out the bottom floor as well as I can. She was up the staircase, here, all on her own. The bomb frowns.
Can you describe her?
I shrug. Thin face, horns. Pretty, I guess. You're all pretty.
What kind of horns?
The bomb asks, tilting her head to one side, as though she's considering something.
Straight? Curved?
I gesture to the top of my head where I remember hers being. Little ones. Goatish, I guess. And she had a tail.
There aren't that many folk in the tower,
the bomb explains.
The woman you're describing.
Do you know her? I ask.
I've never spoken a word to her, the bomb says. But I know who she is. Or who she was. One of Eldred's lovers, who begot him a son. That's Cardin's mother.
Chapter 14. I drum my fingernails against Dane's old desk as the roach leads the prisoner in.
Her name is Asha, he says. Lady Asha.
Asha is thin, and so pale that she seems a little gray. She does not look much like the laughing woman I saw in the crystal globe. She is looking around the room in an ecstasy of confusion. It's clear that she's pleased to be away from the Tower of Forgetting. Her eyes are hungry, drinking in every detail of even this rather dull room. What was her crime? I ask, downplaying my knowledge. I hope she will set the game and show more of herself that way. The roach grunts, playing along.
She was Eldred's consort, and when he tired of her, she got tossed into the tower.
There was doubtlessly more to it than that, but all I have discovered is that it concerned the death of another lover of the High King's and, somehow, Cardin's involvement. Hard luck, I say, indicating the chair in front of my desk, the one to which, 5 long months ago, Cardin had been tied. Come sit. I can see his face and hers. They share those ridiculous cheekbones, that soft mouth. She sits, gaze turning sharply to me.
I have a powerful thirst. Do you know?
The roach asks, licking a corner of his lip with his black tongue.
Perhaps a cup of wine would restore you.
I am chilled, too, she tells him. Cold, down to the bone. Cold as the sea. The roach shares a look with me.
You tarry here with our own Shadow Queen, and I will see to the rest.
I do not know what I did to deserve such an extravagant title, and fear it has been bestowed upon me as one might bestow an enormous troll with the moniker Tiny, but it does seem to impress her. The roach steps out, leaving us alone. My gaze follows him for a moment, thinking of the bomb and her secret. Then I turn to Lady Asha. You said you knew my mother, I remind her, hoping to draw her out with that, until I can figure out how to move on to what I really must know. Her expression is of slight surprise, as though she is so distracted by her surroundings that she forgot her reason for being here. You resemble her very strongly. Her secrets, I prompt. You said you knew secrets about her? Finally, she smiles. Ava found it tedious to have to do without everything from her old life. Oh, it was fun for her at first to be in Fairyland. It always is. But eventually they get homesick.
We used to sneak across the sea to be among mortals, and to take back little things she missed. Bars of waxy chocolate, perfume, pantyhose. That was before Justin, of course. Justin and Ava. Ava and Justin. My mother and my father. My stomach lurches at the thought of there being two people Asha knew better than I ever did. Of course, I echo anyway. She leans forward across the desk. You look like her. You look like them both. And you look like him, I think. You've heard the story, I'll wager, Asha says. How one or both of them killed a woman and burned the body to hide your mother's disappearance from Matic. I could tell you about that. I could tell you how it happened. I brought you here so you could do just that, I tell her. So you could tell me everything you know. Then have me thrown back in the tower? No. My information is worth a price. Before I can answer, the door opens, and the roach comes in carrying a tray piled with cheese and brown bread and a steaming cup of spiced wine. He wears a cape over his shoulders, and after setting down the food, he sweeps it onto her like a blanket.
Any other requests?
He asks. She was just getting to that, I tell him. Freedom, she says. I wish to be away from the Tower of Forgetting. And I wish safe passage away from Innsmore, Innsweel, and Innsmire. Moreover, I want your promise that the High King of Elfheim will never become aware of my release. Eldred is dead, I tell her. You have nothing to worry about. I know who the High King is, she corrects sharply. And I don't want to be discovered by him once I am free. The roach's eyebrows rise. In the silence, she takes a big swallow of wine. She bites off a hunk of cheese. It occurs to me that Cardan very likely knows where his mother was sent. If he has done nothing to get her out, nothing to so much as see her since becoming High King, that's intentional. I think of the boy in the crystal orb, and the worshipful way he stared after her, and I wondered what changed. I barely remember my mother, but I would do a lot to see her again, even just for a moment. Tell me something of value, I say, and I will consider it. So I am to have nothing today? She wants to know. Have we not fed you and clothed you in our own garments? Moreover, you may take a turn around the gardens before you return to the tower. Drink in the scents of the flowers, and feel the grass beneath your feet, I tell her. Let me make myself clear. I do not beg for comforting reminiscences or love stories. If you have something better to give me, then perhaps I will find something for you. But do not think I need you. She pouts. Very well. There was a hag who came across Maddox's land when your mother was pregnant with Vivienne. The hag was given to prophecy and divined futures in eggshells. And do you know what the hag said? That Ava's child was destined to be a greater weapon than Justin could ever forge. Vivi, I demand. Her child, says Asha. Although she must have thought of the one in her belly right then. Perhaps that's why she left. To protect the child from fate. But no one can escape fate. I am silent. My mouth a grim line. Cardin's mother takes another drink of wine. I will not let any of what I feel show on my face. Still not enough, I say. Keeping myself focused on the hope this information will find itself to Baelkin, on the hope that I have found a path to outwitting him. If you think of something better, you can send me a message. Our spies monitor notes going in and out of the Tower of Forgetting, usually at the point they're passed to the palace. Whatever you send, no matter to whom it is addressed, if it leaves the hand of the guard, we will see it. It will be easy to let me know if your memory comes up with anything of more value. With that, I get up and step out of the room. The roach follows me into the hall and puts a hand on my arm. For a long moment, I stand there wordlessly, trying to marshal my thoughts. He shakes his head.
I asked her some questions on the way here. It sounds as though she was entranced by palace life, besotted with the High King's regard, glorying in the dancing and the singing and the wine. Cardin was left to be suckled by a little black cat whose kittens came stillborn.
He survived on cat milk? I exclaim. The roach gives me a look, as though I've missed the point of his story entirely.
After she was sent to the tower, Cardin was sent to Baelkin, he says.
I think again of the globe I held in Eldred's study, of Cardin dressed in rags, looking to the woman in my chamber for approval, which came only when he was awful, an abandoned prince, weaned on cat milk and cruelty, left to roam the palace like a little ghost. I think of myself, huddling in a tower of Hollow Hall, watching Baelkin enchant a mortal into beating his younger brother for poor swordsmanship. Take her back to the tower, I tell the roach. He raises his eyebrows.
You don't want to hear more about your parents?
She gets too much satisfaction in the telling. I'll have the information from her without so many bargains. Besides, I have planted a more important seed. Now I have only to see if it grows. He gives me a half smile.
You like it, don't you? Playing games with us. Pulling our strings and seeing how we dance.
The folk, you mean?
I imagined you'd like it as well with mortals. But we're what you're practiced in.
He doesn't sound disapproving, but it still feels like being skewered on a pin.
And perhaps some of us offer a particular savor.
He looks down his curved goblin nose at me until I answer. Is that meant to be a compliment? At that, his smile blooms.
It's no insult.
Chapter 15. Gowns arrive the next day. Boxes of them, along with coats and cunning little jackets, velvet pants, and tall boots. They all look as though they belong to someone ferocious, someone both better and worse than me. I dress myself, and before I am done, Tatterfell comes in. She insists on sweeping back my hair and catching it up in a new comb, one carved in the shape of a toad, with a single simophane gem for an eye. I look at myself in a coat of black velvet, tipped with silver, and think of the care with which Taryn chose the piece. I want to think about that, and nothing else. Once, she said that she hated me a little for being witness to her humiliation with the gentry. I wonder if that's why I have such a hard time forgetting about what happened with Locke, because she saw it, and whenever I see her, I remember all over again how it felt to be made a fool. When I look at my new clothes, though, I think of all the good things that come from someone knowing you well enough to understand your hopes and fears. I may not have told Taryn all the awful things I've done and the terrible skills I've acquired, but she's dressed me as though I had. In my new clothes, I make my way to a hastily called council meeting, and listen as they debate back and forth whether Nicasia took Cardin's angry message back to Orla, and whether fish can fly. That's Fala.
Whether or not she did doesn't matter, says Matic. The High King has made his position clear. If he won't marry, then we have to assume that Orla is going to fulfill her threats. Which means she's going to go after his blood.
You are moving very fast, says Randolin. Ought we not yet consider that the treaty might still hold?
What good does it do to consider that? Says Mikkel,
with a sidelong glance at Nior.
The Unseelie courts do not survive on wishes.
The Seelie representative purses her small insect-like mouth.
The stars say that this is a time of great upheaval,
says Baefin.
I see a new monarch coming, but whether that's a sign of Cardin deposed, or Orla overturned, or Nikasia made queen, I cannot say.
I have a plan, says Madoc. Oak will be here in Elfheim very soon, when Orla sends her people after him. I mean to catch her out.
No, I say, surprising everyone into looking my way. You're not going to use Oak as bait. Madoc doesn't seem particularly offended by my outburst.
It may seem that's what I am doing.
Because you are, I glare at him, remembering all the reasons I didn't want Oak to be High King in the first place, with Madoc as his regent.
If Orla plans to hunt Oak, then it's better we know when she will strike, than wait for her to move. And the best way to know is to engineer an opportunity.
How about removing opportunity instead, I say. Madoc shakes his head.
That's nothing but the wishes Mikkel cautioned against. I've already written to Vivienne. They plan to arrive within the week.
Oak can't come here, I say. It was bad enough before, but not now.
You think the mortal world is safe?
Madoc scoffs.
You think the Undersea cannot reach him there? Oak is my son. I am the Grand General of Elfheim, and I know my business. Make any arrangement you like for protecting him, but leave the rest to me. This is no time for an attack of nerves.
I grind my teeth. Nerves? He gives me a steady look.
It's easy to put your own life on the line, isn't it? To make peace with danger. But a strategist must sometimes risk others, even those we love.
He gives me a significant look, perhaps to remind me that I once poisoned him.
For the good of Elfheim.
But I bite my tongue again. This is not a conversation that I am likely to get anywhere with in front of the entire council, especially since I am not sure I'm right. I need to find out more of the Undersea's plans, and I need to do so quickly. If there's any alternative to risking Oak, I mean to find it. Randolin has more questions about the High King's personal guard. Madoc wants the lower courts to send more than their usual allotment of troops. Both Nior and Mikkel have objections. I let the words wash over me, trying to corral my thoughts. As the meeting breaks up, a page comes to me with two messages. One is from Vivi, delivered to the palace, asking me to come and bring her and Oak and Heather to Elfheim for Taryn's wedding in a day's time, sooner even than Madoc suggested. The second is from Cardin, summoning me to the throne room. Cursing under my breath, I start to leave. Randolin catches my sleeve.
Jude, he says, allow me to give you a word of advice.
I wonder if I'm about to be scolded.
The Seneschal isn't just the voice of the king, he says. You're his hands as well. If you don't like working with General Madoc, find a new Grand General, one who hasn't previously committed treason.
I knew that Randolin was often at odds with Madoc in council meetings, but I had no idea he wanted to eliminate him. And yet, I don't trust Randolin any more than I do Madoc. An interesting thought, I say, in what I hope is a neutral manner, before making my escape. Cardin is lounging sideways on the throne when I come in, one long leg hanging over an armrest. Sleepy revelers party yet in the great hall, around tables still piled high with delights. The smell of freshly turned earth and freshly spilled wine hangs in the air. As I make my way to the dais, I see Taryn, asleep on a rug. A pixie boy I do not know slumbers beside her, his tall dragonfly wings twitching occasionally as though in dreams of flight. Locke is wide awake, sitting on the edge of the dais, yelling at musicians. Frustrated, Cardin shifts, legs falling to the floor.
What exactly is the problem here?
A boy with the lower half of a deer steps forward. I recognize him from the Hunter's Moon Revel, where he played. His voice shakes when he speaks.
Your pardon, Your Majesty. It's only that my lyre was stolen.
So what are we debating?
Cardin says.
A lyre is either here or gone. Is it not? If it's gone, let a fiddler play.
He stole it.
The boy points to one of the other musicians, this one with hair like grass. Cardin turns toward the thief with an impatient frown.
My lyre was strung with the hair of beautiful mortals who died tragically young,
sputters the grass-haired fairy.
It took me decades to assemble, and was not easy to maintain. The mortal voices sang mournfully when I played. It could have made even yourself cry, begging your pardon.
Cardin makes an impatient gesture.
If you are done with bragging, what is the meat of this matter? I have not asked you about your instrument, but his.
The grass-haired fairy seems to blush, his skin turning a darker green, which I suppose is not actually the color of his flesh, but of his blood.
He borrowed it of an Eve,
he says, pointing toward the deer boy.
After that, he became obsessed, and would not rest until he'd destroyed it. I only took his lyre in recompense, for though it is inferior, I must play something.
You ought to punish them both, says Locke, for bringing such a trivial concern before the High King.
Well?
Cardin turns back to the boy who first claimed his lyre was stolen.
Shall I render my judgment?
Not yet. I beg of you,
says the deer boy, his ears twitching with nerves.
When I played his lyre, the voices of those who had died and whose hair made the strings spoke to me. They were the true owners of the lyre. And when I destroyed it, I was saving them. They were trapped, you see.
Cardin flops onto his throne, tipping back his head in frustration, knocking his crown askew.
Enough,
he says.
You are both thieves, and neither of you particularly skilled ones.
But you don't understand the torment, the screaming.
The deer boy presses a hand over his mouth, recalling himself in the presence of the High King.
Have you never heard that virtue is its own reward?
Cardin says pleasantly.
That's because there's no other reward in it.
The boy scuffs his hoof on the floor.
You stole a lyre, and your lyre was stolen in turn,
Cardin says softly.
There's some justice in that.
He turns to the grass-haired musician.
And you took matters in your own hands, so I can only assume they were arranged to your satisfaction. But both of you have irritated me. Give me that instrument.
Both look displeased, but the grass-haired musician comes forward and surrenders the lyre to a guard.
Each of you will have a chance to play it, and whosoever plays most sweetly, you will have it. For art is more than virtue or vice.
I make my careful way up the steps as the deer boy begins his playing. I didn't expect Cardin to care enough to hear out the musicians, and I can't decide if his judgment is brilliant or if he is just a jerk. I worry that, once again, I am reading what I want to be true into his actions. The music is haunting, thrumming across my skin and down to my bones. Your Majesty, I say, you sent for me?
Ah, yes.
His raven's wing hair falls over one eye.
So are we at war?
For a moment, I think he is talking about us. No, I say. At least not until the next full moon.
You can't fight the sea,
Locke says philosophically. Cardin gives a little laugh.
You can fight anything. Winning, though. That's something else again. Isn't that right, Jude?
Jude is a real winner,
Locke says with a grin. Then he looks out at the players and claps his hands.
Enough! Switch.
When Cardin doesn't contradict his master of revels, the dear boy reluctantly turns over the lyre to the grass-haired fairy. A fresh wash of music rushes through the hill, a wild tune to speed my heart. You were just going, I tell Locke. He grins.
I find I'm very comfortable here, Locke says. Surely there's nothing you have to say to the king that is so very personal or private.
It's a shame you'll never find out. Go. Now. I think about Randolin's advice. His reminder that I have power. Maybe I do. But I am still unable to get rid of a master of revels for a half hour. No less a grand general, who is also, more or less, my father.
Leave, Cardin tells Locke. I didn't summon her here for your pleasure.
You are most ungenerous. If you truly cared for me, you would have.
Locke says as he hops down from the dais. Take Taryn home, I call after him. If it wasn't for her, I would punch him right in the face.
He likes you this way, I think,
Cardin says,
flush-cheeked and furious.
I don't care what he likes, I spit out.
You seem to not care quite a lot.
His voice is dry, and when I look at him, I cannot read his face. Why am I here? I ask. He kicks his legs off the side of the throne and stands.
You,
he points to the dear boy.
Today, you are fortunate. Take the lyre. See that neither of you draw my notice again.
As the dear boy bows, and the grass-haired fairy begins to sulk, Cardin turns to me.
Come.
Ignoring his high-handed manner with some difficulty, I follow him behind the throne and off the dais, where a small door is set against the stone wall, half hidden by ivy. I've never been here before. Cardin sweeps aside the ivy, and we go in. It is a small room, clearly intended for intimate meetings and assignations. Its walls are covered in moss, with small glowing mushrooms climbing them, casting a pale white light on us. There's a low couch, upon which people could sit or recline, as the situation called for. We are alone in a way we have not been alone for a long time, and when he takes a step toward me, my heart skips a beat. Cardin's eyebrows rise.
My brother sent me a message.
He unfolds it from his pocket. If you want to save your neck, pay me a visit, and put your seneschal on a leash.
So,
he says, holding it out to me.
What have you been about?
I let out a sigh of relief. It didn't take long for Lady Asha to pass the information I gave her to Belkin. And it didn't take long for Belkin to act on it. One point to me. I stopped you from getting some messages, I admit.
And you decided not to mention them?
Cardin looks at me without particular rancor, but is not exactly pleased.
Just as you declined to tell me about Belkin's meetings with Orla, or Nikasia's plans for me.
Look, of course Belkin wants to see you, I say, trying to redirect the conversation away from his sadly incomplete list of stuff I haven't told him. You're his brother, whom he kept in his own house. You're the only person with the power to free him who might actually do it. I figured if you were in a forgiving mood, you could talk to him anytime you wanted. You didn't need his exhortations.
So what changed?
He asks, waving the piece of paper at me. Now he does sound angry.
Why was I permitted to receive this?
I gave him a source of information, I say. One it's possible for me to compromise.
And am I supposed to reply to this little note?
He asks. Have him brought to you in chains. I take the paper from him and jam it into my pocket. I'd be interested to know what he thinks he can get from you with a little conversation, especially since he doesn't know you're aware of his ties to the Undersea. Cardin's gaze narrows. The worst part is that I am deceiving him again, right now. Deceiving by omission. Hiding that my source of information, The one I can now compromise is his own mother. I thought you wanted me to do this on my own, I want to say. I thought I was supposed to rule, and you were supposed to be Mary, and that was supposed to be that.
I suspect he will try to shout at me until I give him what he wants,
Cardin says.
It might be possible to goad him into letting something slip. Possible, not likely.
I nod, and the scheming part of my brain, honed on strategy games, supplies me with a move. Nikasia knows more than she's saying. Make her say the rest of it, and then use that against Baelkin.
Yes, well, I don't think it would be politically expedient to put thumbscrews to a princess of the sea.
I look at him again, at his soft mouth and his high cheekbones, at the cruel beauty of his face. Not thumbscrews. You go to Nikasia and charm her. His eyebrows go up. Oh, come on, I say. The plan coming together in my mind as I am speaking. A plan that I hate as surely as I know it will be effective. You're practically draped in courtiers every time I see you.
I'm the king, he says.
They've been draped over you for longer than that. I'm frustrated having to explain this. Surely he's aware of the response of the folk to him. He makes an impatient gesture.
You mean, back when I was merely the prince?
Use your wiles, I say, exasperated and embarrassed. I'm sure you've got some. She wants you. It shouldn't be difficult. His eyebrows, if anything, climb higher.
You're seriously suggesting I do this?
I take a breath, realizing that I'm going to have to convince him that it will work, and that I know something that might. Nikasia's the one who came through the passageway and shot that girl you were kissing, I say.
You mean she tried to kill me?
He asks.
Honestly, Jude, how many secrets are you keeping?
I think of his mother again, and bite my tongue.
Too many.
She was shooting at the girl, not you. She found you in bed with someone, got jealous, and shot twice. Unfortunately for you, but fortunately for everyone else. She's a terrible shot. Now do you believe me that she wants you?
I know not what to believe,
he says, clearly angry. Maybe at her, maybe at me,
probably at both of us.
She thought to surprise you in your bed. Give her what she wants, and get the information we need to avoid a war. He stalks toward me, close enough that I can feel his breath stirring my hair.
Are you commanding me?
No, I say, startled and unable to meet his gaze. Of course not. His fingers come to my chin, tilting my head so I am looking up into his black eyes, the rage in them as hot as coals.
You just think I ought to. That I can. That I'd be good at it. Very well, Jude. Tell me how it's done. Do you think she'd like it? If I came to her like this? If I looked deeply into her eyes?
My whole body is alert. Alive with sick desire. Embarrassing in its intensity. He knows. I know he knows. Probably, I say, my voice coming out a little shakily. Whatever it is you usually do.
Oh, come now,
he says, his voice full of barely controlled fury.
If you want me to play the bawd, at least give me the benefit of your advice.
His beringed fingers trace over my cheek, trace the line of my lip, and down my throat. I feel dizzy and overwhelmed.
Should I touch her like this?
He asks, lashes lowered. The shadows limn his face, casting his cheekbones into stark relief. I don't know, I say, but my voice betrays me. It's all wrong, high and breathless. He presses his mouth to my ear, kissing me there. His hands skim over my shoulders, making me shiver.
and then like this? Is this how I ought to seduce her?
I can feel his mouth shape the light words against my skin.
Do you think it would work?
I dig my fingernails into the meat of my palm to keep from moving against him. My whole body is trembling with tension. Yes. Then his mouth is against mine, and my lips part. I close my eyes against what I'm about to do. My fingers reach up to tangle in the black curls of his hair. He doesn't kiss me as though he's angry. His kiss is soft, yearning. Everything slows, goes liquid and hot. I can barely think. I've wanted this, and feared it. And now that it's happening, I don't know how I will ever want anything else. We stumble back to the low couch. He leans me against the cushions, and I pull him down over me. His expression mirrors my own. Surprise, and a little horror.
Tell me again what you said at the revel,
he says, climbing over me, his body against mine. What? I can barely think.
That you hate me,
he says, his voice hoarse.
Tell me that you hate me.
I hate you, I say, the words coming out like a caress. I say it again, over and over. A litany, an enchantment, a ward against what I really feel. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. He kisses me harder. I hate you. I breathe into his mouth. I hate you so much that sometimes I can't think of anything else. At that, he makes a harsh, low sound. One of his hands slides over my stomach, tracing the shape of my skin. He kisses me again, and it's like falling off a cliff, like a mountainside, building momentum with every touch, until there is only crashing destruction ahead. I have never felt anything like this. He begins to unbutton my doublet, and I try not to freeze, try not to show my inexperience. I don't want him to stop. It feels like a gesh. It has all the sinister pleasure of sneaking out of the house, all the revolting satisfaction of stealing. It reminds me of the moment before I slammed a blade through my hand, amazed at my own capacity for self-betrayal. He leans up to pull off his own jacket, and I try to wriggle out of mine. He looks at me and blinks, as through a fog.
This is an absolutely terrible idea,
he says, with a kind of amazement in his voice. Yes, I tell him, kicking off my boots. I am wearing hose, and I don't think there's an elegant way to strip them off. Certainly, I don't find it. Tangled in the fabric, feeling foolish, I realize I could stop this now. I could gather up my things and go, but I don't. He shucks his cuffed white shirt over his head in a single elegant gesture, revealing bare skin and scars. My hands are shaking. He captures them and kisses my knuckles with a kind of reverence.
I want to tell you so many lies,
he says. I shudder, and my heart hammers as his hands skim over my skin, one sliding between my thighs. I mirror him, fumbling with the buttons of his breeches. He helps me push them down, his tail curling against his leg, then twisting to coil against mine, soft as a whisper. I reach over to slide my hand over the flat plane of his stomach. I don't let myself hesitate, but my inexperience is obvious. His skin is hot under my palm, against my calluses. His fingers are too clever by half. I feel as though I am drowning in sensation. His eyes are open, watching my flushed face, my ragged breathing. I try to stop myself from making embarrassing noises. It's more intimate than the way he's touching me, to be looked at like that. I hate that he knows what he's doing, and I don't. I hate being vulnerable.
I hate that I throw my head back, baring my throat. I hate the way I cling to him, the nails of one hand digging into his back, my thoughts splintering, and the single last thing in my head, that I like him better than I've ever liked anyone, and that of all the things he's ever done to me, making me like him so much is by far the worst.
Chapter 16. One of the hardest things to do as a spy, as a strategist, or even just as a person, is wait. I recall the ghost's lessons, making me sit for hours with a crossbow in my hand, without my mind wandering, waiting for the perfect shot. So much of winning is waiting. The other part, though, is taking the shot when it comes, unleashing all that momentum. In my rooms again, I remind myself of that. I can't afford to be distracted. Tomorrow, I need to get Vivi and Oak from the mortal world, and I need to come up with either a scheme better than Maddox, or a way to make Maddox's scheme safer for Oak. I concentrate on what I am going to say to Vivi, instead of thinking of Cardin. I do not want to consider what happened between us. I do not want to think about the way his muscles moved, or how his skin felt, or the soft gasping sounds he made, or the slide of his mouth against mine. I definitely don't want to think about how hard I had to bite my own lip to keep quiet, or how obvious it was that I'd never done any of the things we did, no less the things we didn't do. Every time I think of any of it, I shove the memory away as fiercely as possible. I shove it along with the enormous vulnerability I feel, the sensation of being exposed down to my raw nerves. I do not know how I will face Cardin again without behaving like a fool. If I cannot attack the problem of the Undersea, and I cannot attack the problem of Cardin, then perhaps I can take care of something else. It is a relief to don a suit of dark fabric and high leather boots, to holster blades at my wrists and calves. It is a relief to do something physical, heading through the woods and then sly-footing my way into a poorly guarded house. When one of the residents comes in, my knife is at his throat faster than he can speak. "Locke," I say sweetly, "are you surprised?" He turns to me, dazzling smile faltering.
"My blossom. What is this?"
After an astonished moment, I realize he thinks I am Taryn. Can he really not tell the difference between us? A bitter pit where my heart should be is pleased by the thought. "If you think my sister would put a knife to your throat, perhaps you should delay your nuptials," I tell him, taking a step back and indicating a chair with the point. "Go ahead. Sit." He sits down just as I kick the chair, sending it backward and him sprawling to the floor. He rolls over, glaring at me with indignation.
"Unchivalrous," is all he says,
but there's something in his face that wasn't there before. Fear. For 5 months, I have tried to use every bit of restraint I learned over a lifetime of keeping my head down. I have tried to behave as though I had only dribs and drabs of power, an important servant's power, and still keep in my head that I was in charge, a balancing act that makes me think of Valmorin's lesson in juggling. I have allowed the Locke situation to get out of hand. I place my foot on his chest, pressing down a little, to remind him that if I kicked hard, it could shatter bone. I am done with being polite. We're not going to play word games or make up riddles. Humiliating the High King is a bad idea. Humiliating me is a terrible idea. Running around on my sister is just dumb. Maybe you thought I was too busy to take my revenge. Well, Locke, I want you to understand that for you, I will make time. His face pales. He's obviously not sure what to make of me right now. He knows I stabbed Valyrian once, but he doesn't know I killed him, nor that I have killed since then. He has no idea I became a spy, and then a spy master. Even the sword fight with Taryn was something he only heard about.
Making you Queen of Mirth was a jest,
Locke says, gazing up at me from the floor with a kind of fondness in his fox eyes. A little smile on the corner of his mouth, as though he's willing me to grin along with him.
Come on, Jude. Let me up. Am I really to believe you'd harm me?
My voice is mock sweet. He once accused me of playing the great game. What was it you called it? The game of kings and princes. Of queens and crowns. But to play it well, I must be pitiless. He begins to get up, but I press down harder with my foot and shift the grip on my knife. He stops moving. You always liked stories, I remind him. You said you wanted to create the sparks of stories. Well, the tale of a twin who murders her sister's betrothed is a good one, don't you think? He closes his eyes and holds out his empty hands.
Peace, Jude. Perhaps I overplayed my hand, but I cannot believe you want to murder me for it. Your sister would be devastated.
Better she never be a bride than wind up a widow, I say, but take my foot off his chest. He gets up slowly, dusting himself off, once on his feet. He looks around the room as though he doesn't quite recognize his own manner, now that he's seen it from the vantage of the floor. You're right, I continue. I don't want to harm you. We are to be family. You will be my brother, and I your sister. Let us make friends. But to do that, I need you to do some things for me. First, stop trying to make me uncomfortable. Stop trying to turn me into a character in one of your dramas. Pick another target to weave stories around. Second, whatever your issue is with Cardin, whatever pushed you to make such a meal of toying with him, whatever made you think it was fun to steal his lover and then throw her over for a mortal girl, as though you wanted him to know the thing dearest to him was worth nothing to you, let it go. Whatever made you decide to make me Queen of Mirth, to torment him with the feelings you suspected he had, leave off. He's the High King. And it's too dangerous.
Dangerous,
he says.
But fun.
I don't smile. Humiliate the king before the court, and the courtiers will spread rumors, and his subjects will forget to be afraid. Soon, the lesser courts will think they can go against him. Locke tries to right the broken chair, leaning it against a nearby table when it becomes clear it will no longer stand on its own.
Oh, fine. You're angry with me. But think, you may be Cardin Seneschal, and you've obviously fascinated him with your hips and lips and warm mortal skin. But I know that in your heart, whatever he has promised you, you still hate him. You'd love to see him brought low in front of his entire court. Why, if you hadn't been dressed in rags and been laughed at, you'd probably have forgiven me for every wrongdoing I've ever committed against you. Just for engineering that.
You're wrong, I say. He smiles.
Liar.
Even if I did like it, I say. It must end. He seems to be evaluating how serious I am, and of what I am capable. I am sure he is seeing the girl he brought home. The one he kissed and tricked. He is wondering, probably not for the first time, how I lucked into being made seneschal, how I managed to get my hands on the crown of Elfheim to orchestrate my little brother's putting it on Cardin's head. The last thing is this, I say. You're going to keep faith with Taryn. Once you're wed, if you want to take other lovers, she better be with you when you do it, and she better be into it. If it's not fun for everyone, it's not happening.